I'm a grateful Al-Anon. My name is Jack, and I am your speaker coordinator. Tonight is my last gig, and I saved some of the best for last, I think. I was told early on in Al-Anon that by my sponsor that I need to have a network. I had to have a safety net. I had to have a group of people that I could fall back on. I need to collect that starting right away. And in the early days, it was at my meeting and surrounding meetings, I began to collect contact information, phone numbers, et cetera. But as I was longer in Al-Anon, began to travel and do service, that net began to get bigger. I started collecting people in other cities. I was told that my very survival and the survival of people that I care about might depend on whether or not I had the right person at the right time in the right place when I needed them. As an example, about 6 weeks ago, a guy, a sponsor, called me up, and his ex-wife had crashed and burned in Austin. She was in bad shape, drugs and alcohol, really bad shape. And he called me up and he said, do you know somebody in Austin? And I said, yes, I do. I'll make a phone call. And I place a phone call to Austin, Texas, to a couple, some friends of mine in AA. 2 hours later, an AA woman with about four of her sponsees showed up at the woman's house and cleaned it from top to bottom to get rid of the drugs and alcohol during the COVID virus and drug her out of there to a meeting. Now, I haven't followed up because it's not my business about how she's doing. I was told that support network would be very important. About, I don't know, Cliff and Lori might correct me, probably 6 or 7 years ago, I went to speak at a conference and I didn't really know too many people, and they had us do a Q&A workshop. I believe it was on traditions, maybe traditions and relationships. And we were up at the DS with about 7 or 8 people, all of the speakers answering questions from the audience. And in the process of answering the questions, both Cliff and Lori and myself, as soon as that thing was over, we didn't come and see you. We didn't talk to anybody else. We went and found each other because we found there was so much in common between us and our approach to an understanding and commitment to the program. And Cliff and Lori are the kind of people, if I got a phone call and said, who do you know in Oklahoma City? I know that if I made a phone call, they would drop what they were doing and go take care of business. They could inevitably wind up saving the life of somebody that's important to me or important to somebody else. It is my great privilege and honor to introduce our speakers tonight. We're going to start with my friend Cliff from Oklahoma City.
Well, thanks, Jack. Hey, everybody. I'm Cliff Gooding. I'm a grateful alcoholic. I'm sober since August the 15th of 2001. And since that short amount of time, I'm as grateful as I know how to be. I hope I can live up to that introduction in this 30 minutes I've got here. So I want to say thanks to Jack for reaching out to Lori and I and ask us to come tonight. It's an honor and a privilege to be asked to do anything. And I really especially like coming to Al-Anon meetings and Al-Anon groups, Al-Anon conventions, and giving an AA talk, because I have so much respect. And so, you know, I talk about Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life, but it was actually Al-Anon that really began the ball rolling when Lori went to Al-Anon and they gave her the tools. So when the time came to put me out of the house, she could do that, which put me on my journey to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm grateful that you all are here tonight, and it's an honor and privilege to be here with you tonight. Happy birthday to all the celebrants. I'm grateful for that. This whole Zoom thing has become quite the deal. I don't know any people who should be better prepared for lockdowns and pandemics than people who rely on God. And that's certainly Al-Anon's and Alcoholics Anonymous. And also I've learned something else during all this time, is that I never was much of a 13th stepper, but since I've been on this Zoom thing, I've noticed I'm kind of a 14th stepper. I like to watch, and so I scroll through the screen. So if you're sitting home wondering, are they paying attention to watching? Yes, we are. We just are. You just need to know that tonight that we're watching. So I'm the kind of kid, when I was growing up, Bill Wilson in the 12 and 12 in chapter on step 5, he wrote about anxious apartness. Dr. Silkworth, in the doctor's opinion, talked about restless, irritable, and discontentedness. And I don't want you to think I have some great insight at 4 and 5 years old, but through a process of inventory, what's happened for me is get some introspection on my life. And I was one of those kids where if I saw my friends with a toy, I would pester my mom and dad to death till I had that toy. And I would have that toy and I would be so happy with that toy for about a week. And then it would get a scratch on it, or it would get dirty or whatever, and I would lose all interest in it. And I'm one of those kids that from the time I was a little boy, I was looking outside always. If I just knew that I would be happier over there. And if I went to where my friends were going, if they said, be here by 7, I would be there. If somebody called me and said, hey, we're doing something at 7, I want to be there. Wherever I am is never good enough. I feel like it needs to be somewhere else. And as I got older, it would be like if I, if I had his car, his girlfriend, if I had his athletic ability, if I was taller, if I had his job, his house, it goes on and on and on. Somehow the information was conveyed to me, and how this happens, I don't know. But if I somehow could fix the outside picture, then inside I would be happy. And when I was 11 years old, under a big old weeping willow tree here in Oklahoma on a hot summer day, my brother opened a big old tall boy country club malt liquor beer and took a big drink and handed it to me. And the magic of alcohol happened. And I say it's the magic of alcohol because that's what the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about the illusion created by alcohol. And that's certainly what happened to me. Because on that day, in that moment, when I drank that beer with my brother, all that anxious apartness that Bill wrote about, the restless, irritable discontentness that Dr. Silkworth speaks so about, evaporated. And I'm going to tell you, my experience with alcohol wasn't that on that day I blacked out, puked, and it was the end of my social drinking. That's not my experience. But by the time I got to high school, I'm a daily drinker. And the legal drinking age in Oklahoma at that time was for men 21 and women 18. But a little zippy mart there in the little town I grew up in, the legal drinking age was old enough to get your money on the counter. And certainly a buddy of mine, we would had a 0 hour class, and we would go in there at 6:30 and we would buy an 8-pack of Pony Millers. I know some of you remember Pony Millers. We'd buy an 8-pack of Pony Millers. We'd split right down the middle. I'd have 6 and he'd have 2. And I would get this cool buzz on, and I would go to school, and I could just kind of deal with the whole school thing. And I became a blackout drinker in college. And by the time I'm there, I'm full-blown alcoholic. And by the time I get out in the workforce, you know, I'm a lawyer by trade. When I went to law school, I collected my first hostage. I know you people know about hostages. You've run into alcoholics in your careers. I know that because you're here. And you know how we alcoholics date? We do that with a U-Haul and a toothbrush, just in case. And so I took my first hostage when I was in law school. That lasted 2 years. I developed this significant problem that on Thursday nights I would go drinking and I would come home on Sunday. She found that objectionable for some reason. And you know, the day I remember that she said, I'm filing for divorce, the thoughts in my head were good, good, because you don't understand. You know, you just don't get it. A guy like me who's going to law school, that's working a job in Oklahoma City. I'm teaching school over to the undergraduates in business law. I'm working all this stuff. I'm doing good in law. You don't get it. You don't understand. A guy like me has a right to go out every once in a while and blow off some steam, to have a drink, you know, to have just a couple of cocktails and go down the road. And the trouble was, in my mind, that's what I really believed. In reality, that's happening every weekend that I do that. I mean, it's every weekend I can't do that. You know, some things I know about my drinking is once I start, something different happens to me than 90% of the population. You know, when I start drinking, I get thirsty. You know, it's best described to explain to you what my drinking looked like. I mean, I would go downstairs after work. There would be 3 other people go down. When I get to the front door of the bar, I'm ordering. Not before the hostess seats us. I'm getting a drink before I sit down. Now, when we get sat down, I'm on my second or third drink by now, because I'm drinking vodka rocks and I'm going. And the cocktail waitress takes the drinks. She brings them back. And probably 15 or 20 minutes, she comes back to check on everybody. And this is how generally the conversation goes. She looks at the first gentleman. He's probably got all of his drink gone, maybe 3/4, and said, "Would you like another?" And he says something strange like this: "No, my wife's cooking dinner. It's going to be ready in an hour, and I need to be home." And he pays his bar bill, gets up, gets in his car. And this is the strange part that some of you will find entertaining: goes home to his wife and they have dinner. And he may not drink again today, tomorrow, next week, next month, next year. He may never drink again. And then there's a second person. This lady probably has half of her drink gone. And she says something like this: "No, I don't want any more. My daughter's in a soccer game tonight, and I need to be there. It starts in 45 minutes. She pays her tab, goes to the soccer game, finds her daughter ahead of time, gives her a hug, tells her how much she loves her. She knows she's going to do great. She goes, sets in the stand with the other parents. She sets in those stands and she cheers for her daughter and the daughter's team. Now, this is important. She doesn't get thrown out. And then after the game, when they go to have pizza or whatever, she goes with the other parents. She may not have a beer with the other parents at that night. She may not have one then. She may not have one tomorrow, next week, next month, next year. She may never drink again. But it's the third person. And this is the person that baffles a guy like me. The third person, she's sitting there and she's got about maybe 1/4 of her drink gone, or maybe it's the worst possible scenario possible. It could be that the ice is melting and the booze is overflowing from the glass. Now, some of you know that who have favors with alcoholics, that we've considered that alcohol abuse. That really is the measure of alcohol abuse. And the waitress looks at her and says, would you like another? And she says the strangest thing of all of them. She says, no, I don't care for anymore. I'm beginning to feel it. And right there, what I think in my head, absolutely. Now we start ordering tequila shooters, because if you're starting to feel it, there's a window. There's a window that alcoholics have to crawl into, and we've got to get there. Because if you're starting to feel it, it's important. But I can tell you this, on days like that, when someone would say that, I knew for a fact that the impact of alcohol on me was significantly different than it was on that person. Because what that person is saying, I don't want anymore, I'm beginning to feel impaired. And see, impairment is not the feeling I get when I drink. When I drink, what happens to me is I feel empowered, and it's a totally different effect. Alcohol has a totally different effect it has on me than the average normal temperate drinker. And if it was just that, it was just the fact that, hey, I just have this when I start drinking, I get thirsty. If it was just that, you know, this allergic reaction that I have to alcohol, this idea that somehow I have this allergy. You know, most people who are allergic to something like peanuts or strawberries or shellfish, they have a negative reaction. You know, they have a negative consequence to that. They just stay away from it the rest of their life. I mean, I've never had anybody who was allergic to peanuts call me from the mall and say, listen, they got yogurt covered peanuts over here. What do you think? I mean, I don't know. You think this is the day? I mean, they just don't do that. But I'm the kind of guy that can have divorces, lost jobs, kicked out of places, and those kind of negative consequences. I never can connect the dots that it's the alcohol. It's that when I start drinking, different bad things happen to me. I can't connect the negative consequences to the drinking. But if it was just that, you know, I would just not drink and you guys would have a different speaker here tonight. And probably none of us would need to be here because we wouldn't be affected by alcohol in that way, because people could just not drink. And if it was just that, then it's the other piece of the puzzle. It's the other piece that makes my life crazy and makes your life crazy, quite frankly. And it's the piece that Lori says, hey, Cliff, will you go to the grocery store to get me something, get a loaf of bread? I'll have dinner ready in an hour. It's Thursday night. I look at my watch and say, absolutely. I trot down to the homeland and get a loaf of bread. Now, I'm coming out of the store. When I come out of the store, I've seen my friend Don. Now, Don and I are old drinking buddies. We've known each other for a long time. Don says, what are you doing? I said, I'm getting bread for Lori. She's cooking dinner. It's going to be ready in 50 minutes. I need to be there. And he says, wait a minute, 50 minutes. He said, we can go over to the Log-In. We can have a couple of beers. You'll be home in 50 minutes. And so when I get information like that, I run that through the keen alcoholic mind. Now, I know in meetings of Al-Anon, y'all never talk about the keen alcoholic mind. But in AA, we talk about the keen alcoholic mind because over there it's relevant. And I run that information through the keen alcoholic mind. I think two beers, 50 minutes, I can do this. And so Don and I, on a Thursday night, we go to the Log-In, have a couple of beers. Now, Sunday when I get home, everybody's mad at me. I mean, she's mad, the dog's mad, the cat's mad, the kids are mad, everybody's mad at me. And you know what? I don't know why. I got the bread. Apparently, there was some more significance to this time requirement on Thursday night I didn't really appreciate. And I don't know what happens to me is, but I gather people up like that when they're mad at me, and I begin to tell them the story. Because there's always a story, you people know. You've heard it 1,000 times. And the story always ends in something like this. I finally turn the conversation to what happened, and I talk about Don. And if I hadn't run into Don, I'd have been home. And the craziest part about that, as I swing the conversation to talk about how it's Don's fault, the funniest thing happens to a guy like me. I begin to believe that's true. In my own delusional thinking, I begin to believe it is Don's fault. And then the craziest thing of all happens. I look at the people that I care about the most. I look into the eyes of the people that I would never hurt. I look in the eyes of my wife and my kids who I would go to the grave for. I look in their eyes and I don't ever want to hurt them. I would never do anything to intentionally hurt them. And I say this, but I'll guarantee you one thing. I can promise you this. This will never happen again. And the strangest part about all that is at the moment that I say that, I mean it. You can put a lie detector test on me and I'll pass it. And the next day I get up and go to church. It's still chilly at my house. I get a little irritated because I apologized yesterday. it's a little chilly at my house. I get in my car, I go down to work, and at work, you know, I get to work and I get to thinking about how they really don't value me there. You know, they really don't respect what I'm doing down there at work. I mean, I'm down there busting my hump 2-3 hours a day. I mean, I'm killing it at work, man. And I get in my car and I'm coming home and I'm thinking about all that. And what happens in that time period is this: somewhere within the next 24, 36, 72 hours on a really good stretch, I find myself drinking again, either intentionally or just I'm 2 beers in. I go, how'd this happen again? And that's the piece of the puzzle that makes my life crazy. It's the piece of the puzzle that makes your life crazy. You know, I can't drink because every time I start, I can't stop. And the other part is I can't not drink. So I can't drink and I can't not drink. And that's alcoholism. And I have no clue about that. And through a series of unfortunate catastrophes, you know, Lori and I met each other. She was my fourth hostage. Because I'll never be one without, and I happen to have a U-Haul and a toothbrush that day. And the horns in my head seemed to fit the holes in hers, and we began to do the alcoholic dance, and she eventually got sick of me. And in the summer of 2001, she had had enough one more time and threw me out. And what I did when she threw me out, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I don't want you to think I went to AA because I knew on that day I was alcoholic. Far from it. I didn't believe I was alcoholic. I didn't believe that was my problem. It seemed to me on that particular day, the biggest problem I had was that I was disposed from my home and I needed to get back in. So I developed what we call an Alcoholics Anonymous, a newcomer plan. Just right on the spot, I developed a newcomer plan. This was my plan. If there's any new members of AA in here that just happen to wander in here, listen up. This is good. You might get some tips from this. I decided what I would do is I would make it maybe 30, 60 days and get everything calmed down at home. And once everything got calmed down at home, I could just gently go back to living my life the way it was. There's some things I didn't know that kind of was afoul in my newcomer plan. One, I didn't know that I was in the grips of a progressive illness. I had no idea that over any considerable time I got worse, never better. The other problem I didn't realize in that regard is that I had friends that I drank with in high school and college. They looked a lot like me. We would go out on Thursday nights drinking and not come home till Sunday, Monday, whatever. And then one day those people met somebody. They met him. They met her. They got these great jobs and they just quit. And you know what happened to them when they just quit? Their life got better. They got promotions at work. They had children. They got houses. They got cars. They had retirement plans. I mean, their life got better. When I went to Alcoholics Anonymous and sat in there, my life didn't get better. My life got progressively worse. You know, this internal spiritual condition that I alluded to at the very beginning, the thing that alcohol fixed for me, the magic of alcohol, the illusion that it created in me that I was okay, it all comes crashing to you. For the alcoholic, removing alcohol is in some extent like removing air. It's what I have to survive because I don't know how to function out there without something in my system. I just don't know how to do that. It seems to me life comes at me with full volume. It's like being on the front row of a Def Leppard concert, you know, right in front of the amplifiers and it's just blowing on me. I told that the other night at a young people's meeting in D.C. and a guy I sponsor was there. He texts me, goes, they have no idea who Def Leppard is, but I know my audience here and I know you guys get it. So there you go. But it's like that. I mean, and it seems that life is happening to me. You know, it's happening to me. And so I rolled into Alcoholics Anonymous and I sat there for 40 days trying to figure out how do I drink and how do I stay sober. And I sat there as long as I could, you know. And on the 40th day, I walked out of an AA meeting, went right to a bar, started drinking on a Thursday. Of course, I didn't come home till Sunday. Now, this is my experience with Al-Anons, and maybe you all can identify with this, but y'all worry about us a lot. Y'all will call and try to track us down. You'll try to find us. You're concerned to no end until we actually show up. And then you're pissed, like, because we actually showed up. You're worried and concerned for hours, for days. We show up, you want to kill us. It's very confusing to us, very confusing. But I showed up. It was no good. She threw me out again. I went to a guy's house. I detoxed for a couple of days. And on August the 15th of 2001, I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous and I sat down. Now, I got to tell you, I didn't know it was going to be that I sat down and the day that I sat down in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd been just as well to take a dart and throw it at a calendar and pick a day. I had no idea it was a day I didn't sober. I didn't come back to AA on August the 15th of 2001 to get sober. I came back with a revised newcomer plan. I knew I had to get back in the house. Once again, that was the problem. And let me, by the way, let me tell you, I had real world problems when I came to AA. I had real world problems. I hadn't worked in like 3 years. I was a functioning alcoholic. I had a wife that worked, you know. I was one of those, what I like to call myself, a go-getter. I'd take her to work and go get her. That's what I would do. But I'm telling you, man, I had real world problems when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I knew these real world problems were not going to be solved by some kind of hocus pocus steps that the people had on the wall there. Now, it was explained to me by my sponsor that these really weren't problems. These are really consequences of my own actions. I didn't like that so much, the way he explained it that way. I like to consider more like problems. But anyway, I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I sat down that day, and the same people, all Charlie Brown's people, were there again that day. Womp, 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 womp. And I'm not alcoholic, so none of this really applies to me. But I'm sitting there at meeting, I'm thinking, how do I drink and how do I stay sober? And there's about 5 minutes, 10 minutes left in this AA meeting, and my head goes stone cold quiet. Now, if you have one of those people that your head just talks to you all the time and it goes quiet, that's an attention getter, quite frankly. And that got my attention. I kind of poked my head up, and a new thought came to me. And the new thought was this: if you don't do something different today, you're going to die. Now, at the time, I had no idea where that thought came from. I'm very clear about where it came from today. But the good people in that AA meeting, they circled up and they said the Lord's Prayer when the meeting was over, and I broke for the door. And when I got to the door, there was an old man there. And what I didn't tell you, when those 40 days I've been coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, that old man had always been there. That he had stopped me every day. And when I was coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, he would say, "Bub, how are you doing?" And I would give him the alcoholic answer: "I'm fine, fine." And he would say, "Well, listen, if there's ever anything I can do for you, let me know." And I'd say, "Man, if there is," and I would be gone. But on August the 15th of 2001, Don caught me one more day at the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. He looked me square in the eye and he said, "Bub, how are you doing?" And I'm going to tell you something. On that day, I gave him a different answer. I said, "Donnie, I'm not doing good at all." And he just looked at me and he said, "I know, I know." And he said, "Well, listen, if there's ever anything I can do for you, let me know." And I said, "Man, I need a sponsor." And I didn't ask him. It wasn't a question. It was a statement. But he was obviously confused and thought I'd ask a question. And he said, "Well, let's talk about that. That's a lot to ask of somebody." And I want to tell you what. Don sat there on that day, and he talked to me about his drinking. He didn't talk to me about mine. And he began to share about what he was like, what had happened to him, and what he was like today. And he talked about this power that he found in Alcoholics Anonymous that had relieved him of his drinking obsession. And he talked about how he, once he got there and then took these actions and this power had entered his life, that how he tried to pass it on to other people. And I'm going to tell you, when Don finished that probably 50-minute hour talk that he gave to me, and I was with rapt attention, I was at the edge of my seat. I mean, and when he concluded, I'm like a high-stakes poker player in Vegas with a winning hand. I pushed all my chips to the middle of the table, and I'm going to tell you something. I went all in on Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been all in on Alcoholics Anonymous from that day to this. That's not to say, and I don't want you to be misguided by this, that's not to say that I haven't had problems, not to say that I haven't had issues in life. You know, we don't get a guarantee that we come here. And anybody that comes to any of these in any of our recovery rooms and talks about how great life is since they've been sober, I don't dispute it's not been great. But life still happens. You know, Bill Wilson, in his story, he talks about that we have to enlarge our and perfect our spiritual life for the certain trials and low spots that await us. And my experience is this. My experience with the 12 steps are as they connected with me with the power that I come to call God today. And through this power, I did exactly what Don promised me on that particular day. And that would I would be relieved of the alcohol obsession. In fact, he said that I could go anywhere in the world that booze was served, and I could go there if my motives were good, because the problem would be removed. And my experience is, for me, at least, it has been so. And I got busy in the steps, and I got busy doing the things that Alcoholics Anonymous has asked me to do. And I've been trying to the best of my ability to do to be the kind of demonstration that Don was for me, not just in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, but where I work, with my family, with my friends. You know, if I go to Alcoholics Anonymous and, you know, quite frankly, on some nights at the coffee bar, hell, I'm the damn Dalai Lama over there. I mean, I'm espousing some stuff that will make you believe I'm almost reaching water walker status. I mean, I'm good. I mean, I'm laying it down. But I walk out the door and I get in traffic and I'm helter-skelter all over again, man. And what Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me, and what is the most important thing I believe for a guy like me, is not so much what I do with her that hour between the Serenity Prayer and the Lord's Prayer that we do here, but can I take that 1 hour that I spend there and can I transfer that to the other 23 hours between the Lord's Prayer and the next Serenity Prayer? And can I go from this dualistic life, this double life of an alcoholic that I've lived, and can I merge those into one whole person to where I'm the same guy at the coffee bar, the same guy with the bank teller, the same guy with the slow person in traffic, and the same guy at the Subway sandwich shop who don't get my change right? Can I be that same guy at all those places? And I want to tell you that 95% of the time, God gets it right. And I'm able to be a whole person, a unified person, not a dualistic person today. I want to thank Jack for having me here tonight. I'm really grateful birthday night to be here. Congratulations. And thank God for Al-Anon and thank God for all of you for putting us black knuckleheads like us. God bless.
And next I get to introduce my friend, Lori. Lori, tell us the rest of the story.
Hi, everybody. My name is Lori Gooding. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. My recovery date is July 1st, 2001. And I have a home group, and it's called the Start Fresh Group. And we meet on Mondays at 5:30. And we're actually meeting in person and still on Zoom today. And we're allowed to do that. We have all the restrictions and stuff, but we are absolutely allowed to meet in person. I haven't gone in person. I'm still doing it on Zoom, but we are still meeting in person. And thank you, Jack, for asking us to do this. And it's late for me. I'm just going to tell you my bedtime was about an hour ago, but I'm staying up for you. And, you know, I didn't grow up in an alcoholic home. My parents aren't alcoholics, and we didn't even have alcohol in our house. But I have two older sisters and an older brother, and my brother died 2 years ago of this disease. And he died the alcoholic death that you read about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to tell you that my brother and I I'd said and done everything that I could do and say with my brother in the shape that he was in. And the last conversation that we had was a really good one. And I'd learned to love my brother for who he was and what he was. And I hadn't tried to change him or fix him in years. And that's because of you people. And I am the baby, and I have never drank or done a drug in my whole entire life. Alcoholics love hearing that because they go into shock. But you guys understand because you know that we have control issues. And I had seen what my brother had gotten in trouble, and I'd seen I have a sister that drinks a lot, and she doesn't think she's an alcoholic, but she gives it a good impression of one. I don't know if she is or not, but I'd seen they always had consequences and troubles and problems. And so I just decided at a young age I wasn't going to drink or do drugs, and I just never did. You people know that's because I was really sick, and that's the truth. I had to be the good girl, and I was trying to do everything right. My parents divorced when I was 7. I went to go live with my mom. I'm a daddy's girl, so that was really hard for me. And when I was 16, I got to move in with my dad. And he was dying at the time, and that was really scary. What I did is I kept my distance from my dad because I was afraid that if he was going to die, it was going to hurt too bad if I was too close to him. And so that was my way of dealing with that. I just tried to control that. And what happened was my senior year, my week of my high school graduation, he got a kidney transplant and it saved his life. And I got to spend another 14 years with him. And I got married at 19. I married a guy I wish I could tell you that I knew that he was the love of my life and that we were going to live happily ever after. I married him because he asked. I met him in September. We got engaged in November and we got married in March. And it was not a popular decision at my house or with anybody around me, by the way. And I have this thing. I don't know if any of y'all understand this, but I always wanted to do everything right. And I always wanted to be the good girl. And I wanted to make my parents proud. And so along with that comes this, I'm never wrong. I don't apologize and I never make mistakes. And so if everybody would just listen to me, we would all be fine because I'm always right. And so I get married to this guy. I instantly know it's the biggest mistake of my life. I know I've screwed up, but I can't admit it. And because I don't want to hear I told you so, and I can't admit that I'm wrong. So I just stick with it. And we had a little boy, and after about 7-8 years of marriage, I was wanting out of that marriage, and I didn't know how to get out of it. I really didn't know how to get out of it. And I was working at a bank in Oklahoma City, and the way out of my marriage, walked through the door. He was the best looking thing I've ever seen. He's about 5'6". I have this thing for short guys. I don't know what it is. You're short, I'm going to like you. If you're short and alcoholic, I'm going to love you. And I loved this one. He was 5'6". He had dark brown hair and these baby blue eyes, had this bright smile, and he had this tan, and he always was dressed to the nines, and he was the attorney for the bank, and he was on my board of directors, and he was on the loan approval committee, and all the guys shook his hand and patted him on the back when he walked in the door, and all the girls giggled and batted their eyes, and I went and hid because I couldn't form a sentence around him, and that had never happened before. And I started dating this guy, and I noticed he's crazy, but he's a lot of fun. And I mean, we have fun, and we had a lot of fun hanging out. And you know, I can tell you a lot of stories, but this is the one that is probably my favorite. I very rarely tell this one, but this is probably my favorite to kind of give you an idea about this guy. He had went to treatment in the 80s, and he had been gone for about a month, and he came home, and there's a little boy that lived next door that was about 5 years old, and he came home and he said, hey, Cliff, where you been? And he said, I couldn't tell him I'd been in treatment. So I just said, well, I've been out of town. He goes, oh, my mom said you're probably in jail. So that kind of gives you an idea of what people thought about him and what kind of guy he was. Let's just leave it at that. But he was crazy. We were having a lot of fun. And I noticed that he didn't sleep very well for like days at a time. And then he sleeps for like days at a time. And I'm curious about this, and I ask him about it, and he tells me he has a sleeping disorder that he's had since college, and I said, you know, you need to get that fixed, because that's not right, you need sleep, and he's like, you know, I've been to doctors, and I've done sleep studies, and they can't figure it out, and I don't know what happens when you get information like that, but what happens when I get information like that is I'm going to figure it out for you, thank you very much, and we're going to fix you. You obviously didn't go to the right doctors. You're not giving them the right information. And I'm going to do my own sleep study. And so I move in with him. And I move in with him because you have to watch him 24/7 if you're going to do your own sleep study. Because I'm pretty sure he's drinking too much coffee and taking in too much caffeine, too much screen time. I'm going to figure it out. I'm here. The rescuer has arrived, just so you'll know. And so I come in and I start inquiring and I start watching and I start asking questions. And it seems like when I start doing that, we start having fights. And the more that I question, the more that I look into, the more that I investigate, the more fights that we have. And it gets, you know, we just start screaming and yelling at each other. And you know, it's not like people hadn't warned me or tried to warn me or tried to talk to me about this. And people that knew me and knew Cliff and would call me up and say, hey, I hear you're dating Cliff Gooding. And I'd say, yeah. And I'd say, you know him? And they go, oh yeah. And I'd say, well, tell me what you're thinking. What's going on? Tell me what you think about him. And he'd say, well, and this is generally the conversation almost every time. They'd say, well, you know, he's a brilliant man. And I knew that. He did his undergraduate in 3 years. He graduated top 5% of his law school. And he was seventh in his class. And they said, he's really successful. And I knew that he had this huge law firm when I first met him, had all these people working for him. And they'd say, and he's a lot of fun. And like I said, I already knew that we were having a lot of fun. And then they said something like this, but he's a liar. He's a cheat. He's arrogant. He's egotistical. You cannot trust him as far as you can throw him. You really need to stay away from him. And that's what they said. And what I heard was he needs you. And that's what I always hear. That's what I work on. And so I'm trying to figure him out and get him fixed. And we start having fights and listen, and they got ugly. I'm just going to tell you, we don't have like disagreements. We have screaming matches. It's World War III every day, almost every day. And, you know, unfortunately we had two little kids at this time. I had a son that I brought from my marriage, and he had a daughter that he brought from his previous marriage. And, you know, unfortunately, those kids have heard us say and do things to each other that I wouldn't say or do to my worst enemy today. And that's unfortunate, but that's the truth. And so we got in a huge fight one time and I left and because I kept my apartment at first and I had left and he called me and he said, you know, I think we should do. And I said, what? He said, I think we should go see a counselor. And I thought that was a great idea. I'd never been to a counselor before, but I thought that was a great idea. And so I went to this counselor and she gave me this intake sheet to fill out. And it had questions on it like this. Have you ever drank more than two or three drinks at a time? Have you ever taken illegal drugs? Have you ever abused prescription drugs? Have you ever had more than two sexual partners at a time? Have you ever dressed promiscuously? I was checking no as fast as I could check no on that thing, thinking, who comes in here? I mean, really, I just need some marital advice, I mean, some relationship advice, and I don't know what this is all about. And so she took that piece of paper and looked at it and looked at me, and she goes, well, looks like the only thing sick about you is that you're dating Cliff Gooding. Let's talk about that. And that's what she said. And I swear what I heard was, see, it's him. It's not you. He's the problem. And so that's what I based our counseling on. He was the problem. And we went regularly because he was the problem. And by God, she was going to help me fix him. And that's what I went on. And that's what we did. And we went for a couple of years and, you know, and finally she got sick of us and sent us to somebody else. And we'd been to this lady about three times. And on this visit, we were, once again, Cliff had been staying up 3 days at a time. And he was crazy and I was crazy and I was about had it. And she said, okay, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to write you a prescription for tranquilizers. I'm going to give you one at 6. And if he's not asleep, give him another one at 10 and you go to bed. And I said, okay. And that's what I did. Gave him one at 6, gave him one at 10. I went to bed. I got up the next morning. He wasn't in bed with me, which is at this time not an uncommon occurrence. And by the way, I got married at this, but we did get married. And anyway, I got up and he was asleep in our mother-in-law room on the other side of the house. We have a mother-in-law playing in our house, and he was in this guest room on the other side of the house. And I went to open the door, and he had barricaded it shut, which had never happened before. And the other door was locked. And I don't know if you're anybody like my type. I think there might be a few on here. We can get in anywhere. I mean, like a barricaded door is not going to stop people like us. We can get in anywhere. There's a drunk in Fort Knox. We're going to get you out. I'm just telling you, we will hunt, seek, and destroy. We got it. And I'm still convinced. I mean, I think it's just an innate ability that we can hunt you guys down. I mean, we can hunt them down. We can find them. We can retrieve them. We're really good at that. If they would have told a bunch of Al-Anons that Osama bin Laden was a drunk and his family needed him at home, there would have been no need for military action. We would have got him. I promise you, we would have found him. And so I break in on him. He has passed out. There's an empty bottle of wine and an empty bottle of vodka next to the bed. And on top of the adult videotapes that had ran out was this little clear package with some white substance in it. And that's how I found out what was going on. And I was a little upset, you might imagine. And I took that deal and I hit him as hard as I could hit another human being. He bolted up out of that bed and I shook that package at him and I said, what the heck is this? And he looked at that package and he looked at me. He goes, I don't know. And he likes to tell it when he tells his story. I guess those people that barricaded me in here must have dropped it on their way out. But anyway, we had another fight and I asked him, I told him to leave the house and he did. And he came back a couple hours later and I said, and you know, you can't stay here. And he said, what do you want me to do? And I said, why don't you go tell Wilma what you've been doing? And Wilma is his daughter's, our daughter's mother, my stepdaughter's mother. And she had been in Al-Anon, I mean, in AA for about 13 or 14 years at the time. And he said, okay. And so he left and he went and told her. And he came back and he said, I went and told her. And she took me to a meeting. We're going to do 90 meetings in 90 days. And I had no idea what he was talking about. It was Greek to me. I had no idea what he meant. And I said, great, I don't care. You're not staying here. And so he left and I called Wilma. And I wish I could tell you that I called Wilma because I knew she had 13 or 14 years in AA. And that would be a good source for me. But I called Wilma to check up on him. And I said, did he tell you what he's been doing? And she said, yes. And we're going to do 90 meetings in 90 days. Still didn't know what she was talking about. And I said, that's great. What do I do? And she said, would you be willing to go to a meeting with me tomorrow? And I said, yes. Now I'm going to tell you why I said yes. I'd tried everything in the world to get this man to do what I wanted him to do. I've tried threatening, pleading, begging, crying, screaming. I have done it all. I have searched through pockets. I have searched through cars. I have followed him. I have looked through emails. I've listened to voicemails. I've tried everything that I could possibly try to get him to do and act the way that I thought he should do and act. And I was pretty much out of ideas. The only other thing that I was going to do, the only other plan I had left was I was going to kill him. I think one of the worst things that can happen for untreated Al-Anons is for us to watch too many episodes of 48 Hours Mysteries and Forensic Files, because I have planned his death so many times, you have no idea. And I have learned from those people's mistakes, and I promise you, I can get away with it. And so murder or a meeting. So I thought, what's it going to hurt? I'll just go to the meeting. What's going to help? And so she took me to my first meeting and my second meeting and my third meeting. And I don't know how you guys got here to your program. I got here with the ex-wife. And I started going to Al-Anon. And 45 days later, Cliff relapsed. And once again, we had a fight. And once again, I kicked him out of the house. And once again, I called Wilma. And she said, you know what I think we should do? And she said, I think we should go to see an attorney and we should get supervised visitation with our kids. And I thought that was a great idea. And I wish I could tell you that I said that because I wanted to protect our kids, but I did that because I wanted to punish him. Because not only do I like to be right and I never admit that I'm wrong, but I love to punish. I am really great at revenge. And so that was what my plan was. And I went to go see this attorney and she said, do you want a divorce? And I said, no. And she said, what do you want? And I said, I just want him to be okay. And she said to me, if that's true, then what you need to do is you need to think about what you're willing to do and what you're not willing to do. And you need to be really matter of fact about it and don't say anything that you don't mean. And when you go home to talk to him, you need to be very calm. Now, I'm just going to tell you, there are 1,000 adjectives that can describe me and calm ain't making the list. I've never been calm in my life. I don't know what calm is. I've never been around calm. I thrive in chaos. That's how I run. And so the only thing I'd known after going to Al-Anon for 45 days was a serenity prayer. I had a really good job at the time. And I drove around in my car a lot and I said the serenity prayer all day. And I asked Cliff to meet me at home that night. And he did. And when he came home, I said, these are the words that came out of my mouth. I said, I know this must be hard. And I know you have a problem and I know you must be scared and I'm willing to do whatever I need to do. If I need to go to counseling or treatment myself or meetings or whatever it is that I need to do, I'm willing to do. And I'm willing to do my part, but only if you can do your part. And if you can't do your part, I can't stay. And that may not sound like a big deal to you, but I'm going to tell you, up until that point, I've never been okay without him, whether it was this him or the him before him or the him before him. I've always had to have him. And I've never been okay without them. And so for me to know that if he wasn't going to do it, I was going to leave and I knew I was going to be okay. It was the first time I felt that. It was the first time I'd felt okay in my own skin. It was the first time I felt okay no matter what he was going to do or say. And if he would have said, screw you, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And if you don't like it, leave. I knew it was going to be okay. But he didn't say that. And he said, you're right, I have a problem. I don't have a sleeping disorder, which I kind of figured out, but you know, nice for the verification. And I said, well, what are you going to do different? Because I knew he was going to AA. And he said, I'm going to ask a man to sponsor me tomorrow. And I know that he'll hold me accountable and I'm going to do whatever he asked me to do. And I said, okay. And the next day, that's what he did. He went to that meeting and he asked that man to sponsor him and he's been sober ever since. And that left me with me and I'm just going to meetings and I don't have a sponsor and I'm just going to meetings and I'm watching and I'm waiting. And here's what it looks like at our house. I'm waiting and watching because by God, he's going to relapse. I'm going to catch him and I'm going to punish him because that's what I do. And I'm waiting and I'm watching and I'm doing all the things that they tell you not to do in Al-Anon. I'm doing them all. What meeting did you go to today? Who did you go with? When did you talk to your sponsor? What did you say to your sponsor? What did he say to you? When's the last time you talked to him? What are you doing tonight? I gave you $20 this morning. What would you do with it? I'm doing everything that they tell you not to do. We get in a fight, I'd call his sponsor because I didn't have one. And so, everything that they tell you not to do, I did. And I'm going to meetings and I am sharing about this in meetings, by the way. And that's why I love you people. We're so patient with the newcomer for so long. And then after about a couple of months, they're like, oh my God, do you have a sponsor? And that's kind of what happened. Somebody goes, do you have a sponsor? And I was like, oh, I probably should get one of them. And I asked this lady, there's a lady that I've been to meetings with and I loved her. Every time that she shared, I felt like she was talking about me. I felt the way that she had felt. It was just like, oh my gosh, this lady knows me. And she's so sweet. And I asked her to sponsor me and she said, give me a call tonight. And I did. And I called her and she said, okay, tell me why you think you need Al-Anon. And so I told her everything he had ever done. I told her all about him. He did this and he did that. And I went on and on about him. And finally she stopped me and she said, well, now we know he's not the problem, you are. Let's talk about that. She seemed so sweet in those meetings. And then Hitler came out and she, but you know what? It's exactly what I needed to hear, because as soon as she said that, I mean, the instant she said that, it was like I had been struck by lightning. I was like, oh my God, I'm powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable by me. And it had nothing to do with him. He was getting better. He was going to meetings. He was taking the steps. He had a sponsor. And I was a crazy woman. I was a crazy woman. I was still doing the same thing. And that woman took me through the steps, and she's still my sponsor this day. I've had the same sponsor for 19 years. She's saved my bacon more times than I can count. And she keeps me accountable. She does not let me get away with anything. And I'm forever grateful to her. And I'm just going to tell you about a couple of the steps, because I don't have time to go through all of them. But when I did my four step, we were remodeling our kids' rooms at the times. And the only thing left to do in our daughter's room was to get bedding for her room. And I was at work, and it was on a Friday, and Cliff called me and he said, hey, guess what Rachel and I did today? And I said, watch. He goes, we went and got our bedding. And I'm going to tell you, the first thought I had was, how dare you do that without me? How dare you do that without my approval or my input? But I didn't say that because I had a sponsor. I just said, okay. And I hung up the phone and I got home that night and I said, well, let's see what y'all got. And they showed me. And I said, you know what? That color doesn't match her room. And that material is so thin, she's going to tear it up in no time. And you spent way too much money on that. You know, the guy was trying to do a really good thing for me and I just ripped him to shreds. And the next morning I got up to go do my fifth step. And I took that stuff and I threw it in the trunk of the car because I was going to go take it back because I know better, because I'm always right. And I go to do my fifth step. And when I get to her house, we get started and I barely had started on my fifth step. And she stopped me because she said, I got to go get a drink. And she went to go get some water and she came back and she goes, now, listen, before we continue on this fifth step, is there anything that might have happened that's not on this fifth step that you want to tell me about? And I thought, oh, my God, he called her. And I said, yes. And she said, what is it? And so I told her about the bedding. And she said, do you know what you did when you did that? I said, yes. Once again, I had to be in control. And once again, I had to be right. And I had to have it my way. And she said, no, that's not what you did. She said, when you told her that color didn't match her room, you told her opinion did not matter. And when you told her that material was so thin, she'd tear it up in no time. You let her know that no matter what decision she made for the rest of her life, you would always know better. And when you told her it cost too much, you told her she wasn't worth it. And you see, those are the exact nature of my wrongs. And that's the kind of stuff I've been doing to people my whole life. And I'd never given it a thought. That was the damage I was causing every day to everybody I knew, because I have the arrogance to think that somehow I know better than you and that I'm right. And that, you know, you don't know what you're talking about if you would just listen to me. That's what I've been doing to people my whole entire life. And I'd never given it a thought. And I'm going to tell you, when I got done with that fifth step, we went back through my fifth step and we identified the exact nature of my wrongs in every episode and every relationship and everything that I had said and done. And we identified the damage I had done. And when I got done with that fifth step, I was both horrified and elated at the same time, because I now could see face to face what my part was. I couldn't blame everything on him anymore or my parents or whoever. And I had to take ownership of that. And I knew who I was, but I also knew that I didn't have to be that way anymore. And that the rest of these steps was going to get me out of that. And that I could change and that I could have new behavior. And we went back through these steps. We went through the rest of these steps so that I could do that. And, you know, we did 8 and 9 and we did the rest of those steps. And, I think the 12th step is so important, not just because that we share our experience with somebody else, but because we have to practice these principles in all of our affairs. And people just kind of throw that away sometimes. They just kind of ignore that part of it. Having had a spiritual awakening, which is a promise, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, which means you're going to have one, we've tried to carry this message to others in my program because we've tried to take it to alcoholics. Y'all don't listen. And we practice these principles in all our affairs. And that is huge and key for me because I can't pick and choose today on which areas of my life that I'm going to practice these principles. If I'm going to the doctor and he says to me, hey, listen, your blood pressure's up and you're a little overweight, you need to really watch your diet. And every time I sit down, I eat like I'm going to the electric chair. I am not practicing these principles in all my affairs. You know, if I am really sweet in these meetings and I sound really fun and cute in these meetings, but then when I get off, I start talking horrible to my husband or talking down to my coworkers or treating people around me like trash because I'm some sort of authority or something. I am not practicing these principles in all my affairs, and I do not have the luxury to pick and choose today on where I practice these principles. I practice them in all of my affairs, in all areas of my life, not just with the alcoholics in my life and not just with alcoholism, because it's deadly for me. It's deadly for me to do that. And my dad died a month before I got in this program, and I became really close to my stepmom, and she got sick it's been about 10 years ago, I guess now. And she got really sick and she had never been sick a day in her life. And she was having problems breathing, and come to find out she had organized pneumonia, and she had been in and out of the hospital for months. And she had gotten remarried to this man named Herschel, who, by the way, was 5'6", cute little guy. Anyway, she had gotten sick And I was at the hospital on a Monday night, which is when my home group meets, and I was talking to her and she was doing great. And I went home that night and went to my home group, and everything was going good. And then that Saturday I got a call that she had passed away, and I was not expecting that. And so I went to go out to their house, and it was just me and Herschel, and we were waiting for my sisters and stuff to get there. And I don't know why I asked this question, because it is not something that I would normally ask. It is not something I would normally do. But I asked him, I said, she was having trouble breathing. When she would come home, she insisted on sleeping in her bed at the top of the stairs, and she would literally collapse in bed because she'd be out of air. And so Herschel had put this chair lift in for her, and it had gotten installed the day before she went to the hospital. And for some reason, I asked him this question again. I don't know why I did, but I said, Herschel, how much did you pay for that chairlift? And he said, I don't know, like $2,700. And I said, and she got to use it one time. And he looked me, and he did not skip a beat. He looked me square in the eyes and he goes, it was worth it. And what that taught me was this: no matter what's happened to me in my life, and no matter what pain I've caused others, and whatever has happened to me and caused me pain, if it got me to you, it was worth it. You see, I would not change a second of my life if it was going to cost me being here, because this program has given me a God of my understanding that I never had before. And that God has given me everything. And I have a really good life today. It's not perfect. I still have problems. I've still had death. I've still had sickness. I've still had financial issues. I've had all of that throughout the years, but I would not trade this life for anything. Everything that I have today, that I'm the mother that I am today, I'm the sponsor I am today, I'm the wife that I am today, I am everything that I am today because of you and this program and the God of my understanding. There's a couple that was here, and they were great members of AA, and she was a dual member and also an Al-Anon, and they were an American Indian couple, and their name was Jack and Hody Mitchell. And Jack died with 42 years of sobriety. And I think Hody had 37 years of sobriety. And she was also a member of Al-Anon. And she had this prayer that she learned. And she learned it at an American Indian AA meeting in Arizona. And she brought it back to us. And there's a few of us that still know it. And every time that I speak, I close with it. And it goes like this: I've been told that the reason we join hands is to remind us of the truth that we are no longer alone. Our prayers for the still suffering in these rooms and on the streets. Hold on to the person's hand next to you like your life depends on it, because someday it may. Thank you for allowing me to be here tonight. Thank you for holding my hand.